We went on a bike ride. That was nice.
Wait.
Yeah.
You're one of them. You're one of the people that got in the way of my trip outside of the house.
What?
I walked the park.
I didn't get the
16 days in the house, and I was like, I need to go outside and get a walk. I need some movement. I need blood flow. So I walked to the park for about 5 minutes, and there were so many people biking and jogging and huffing and puffing all over the place that I turned right around and came home.
Yeah, one of the things I've found, because we go on a couple, two, three bike rides a week, is that different people have very different ideas of what the 4 meters is, because we're bad at metric in the US. So like, my idea of 4 meters being based in science and reality is about 12 or 13, about 15 or 16 feet. Most people's idea of 4 meters is like two arm lengths away, which is not sufficient for social distancing guidelines in my world.
I think you should just do what Mike Micah does and stay in the basement.
That's what I do. I mean, why would I leave?
I know. Look at the, like, people can't see it. This is going to play very well on an audio show, but if you could see the room that he's sitting in right now, I would never leave that room either.
Welcome to another episode of Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad. Right there in the episode, in the show title.
It's like your name is in the title.
I know.
You're a headliner.
Almost like we planned it that way.
We didn't plan it that way at all. No. This week, though, as you may have guessed from the cold open, we are joined by a very special guest. One, Mike Micah. He is the studio head of Digital Eclipse and a board member of the Video Game History Foundation, and a long time. He's a friend of the pod that has been a friend of the pod so long. He's been a friend before there was a pod.
Yeah, way before.
Welcome to the show, Mike. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, no, this is great. It's, you know, with everything that's going on, this is like one bit of normalcy that usually would have been a little outer, like not so normal before. But now it feels like I can actually connect with people by doing these.
The human contact, it turns out, from a hour long podcast is really nice.
Yeah, you know we will take what social interaction we can get these days in whatever exactly. Form. So I have to ask right off the bat, what does it feel like to be a board member?
Oh, you know, I've always dreamed of being a board member because I've heard of other people being board members, like Ed Fries, for instance, who's from Microsoft. He's on the board of like every tech company in the world. And he seems to be having a lot of fun. So I kind of wanted to do that. I don't know really. All I know is like I get asked a lot of questions and I just say a lot of opinions and then I get asked to do things a lot. And then I usually buy food, too, if we have meetings in person. But we don't do that anymore. So I save money.
Did you get to say things like we need to increase productivity 30% by February or else we're going to shut the whole thing down and then bang your fist on the table?
You know, I do that, but it's so out of context that people just look at me funny.
Well, like you're living the dream. You just get to have opinions and people care about them.
That's exactly what it is. I mean, essentially, it's just I think from my perspective, it seems like a board member is just somebody who's done a lot of something that's important to the people who ask you to be on the board. So in this case, with the Video Game History Foundation, I know a lot about classic games and finding old games and finding source code and weird stuff. So that kind of became important, I guess.
Yeah, like honestly, in all honesty, you having done a lot of something is exactly why we wanted to bring you on. And that something, of course, is, you know, making games, getting your hands on games for a very long time. We talked about your basement setting there in the intro, but it's just a who's who of Dragon's Lair posters and Street Fighter II machines. and I see you post pictures of that place on Twitter all the time. And it looks like the most comforting room on the planet to me because it's literally just wall to wall, old computers, old games, old, arcade hardware, old CRTs. Honestly, when I think like who's an expert in old games in the Bay Area, like you're definitely one of the first names that comes to mind.
Oh, thanks. It's one of those things I think I was born to do.
So I guess we kind of wanted to just kick this thing off with just a little background on how you got started and all this stuff in terms of like what your earliest experiences were making games, like coding, getting your hands on old computers, like what platforms, what languages, like how you got into programming and stuff like that. I'm just kind of curious, like when you got your start and how.
Okay. I mean, it was a long time ago. I was probably in, it was like third grade, whatever year that was. 1980 something, And I was a huge fan of arcade games. And it was one of those things where it was that time when everybody had an arcade machine. So you could go to a laundromat, you can go to like a restaurant, you can go like go play tennis or whatever. There's always an arcade machine within like 10 feet of wherever you were. There's everywhere. And so I got really into arcade games like everybody else did back then. And one day I think it was third grade, actually, just out of the blue in class, they wheeled in an Apple II on a little rolling cart. And it was kind of cool. It looked like it was from the future and everything. And they were talking about everything it could do. And I was kind of excited, but like, I'm still like, you know, hardcore video game nerd. Didn't realize there was a connection yet until my teacher brought up that she was saying, oh, you can keep records on this. You can do all this other stuff. It was all boring. And then she's like, oh, and this is what you use to make video games, like those games you guys like to play. And that, like, my mind just like froze in that moment. It's like, wait, what did she just say? And so she continued to talk about everything else, but I kept raising my hand going like, so what do they use to make video games on it and all this kind of stuff? She didn't know how to answer it. So my friend, who was also just as crazy as I was, convinced to stay in on recess or during recess to use the computer and try to figure out how to program on it. And over like, I probably say like half that school year, we started to teach ourselves how to program. We would get these books from my friend's brother and we would just sit down with them and try to type in stuff and learn how to do it. And by the end of it, we had like these little games that we had made, and I was just already going crazy over that and addicted to it. But all that while, I still didn't have a computer at home. So the other thing that would happen is like my parents would go shopping to this department store, and they would always take like 2 to 3 hours. And so now that I had started to learn how to use computers, I would go to the computer section, and that time they would always have the big 8-bit computers around this big circle, and you could try every one of them on. They were all just on, and none of them really had anything on them other than their prompts. Like when you started up, it would always say like ready or whatever, and you could just type on it. They would occasionally pull down games if you asked to look at something, and they put it in there. But since I knew how to start programming a little bit on the Apple II, I decided I'd try doing that with the Commodore 64 because it looked like it had some pretty cool stuff on it. And it was kind of cool because the department store right near where the computer section was, right next to this book section where they would sell books. And in that area, they had a whole bunch of like creating games on home computers. So I'd grab those books, type in things over on the display models. And within that 2 hours, I'd learn some stuff every single time. And one time when my dad came to grab me before we left, he came by and I was playing this little Moon Patrol game. He's like, oh, which game is that? I'm like, it's a game I made. And he's like, what? I'm like, yeah, I made it like this. I showed him how I did it. And then literally like 1 week later, we had a Commodore 64 at home. My dad was just like super cool. He's like, just keep doing that thing you do where you're making that stuff. And I'm like, all right.
That's awesome.
Budding child entrepreneur. What kind of, let me preface this question by saying I am asking these questions from the position of a layman. So forgive any ignorance or naivete, but like what kind of languages were you working with back then? Was it just like BASIC and stuff like that, or was it easy to get like actual access to the hardware?
Everything back then pretty much used BASIC as a starting point. And so I learned BASIC like everybody else, but then I remember there was a few things I would get. Like we would trade a lot of software, and one of the biggest trading places usually back then was on bulletin boards, and also just people you'd know. You'd trade games like pirate games and all stuff. And I remember I was talking to this whole other thing, too. I was talking to this older lady named Mrs. Cripps, who was the neighborhood software pirate. She was like 80 years old. She was a chain smoker. And all the kids in the neighborhood ride their dirt bikes to her house. So her front lawn was always covered in dirt bikes. And inside there was just stacks of drives and just games getting copied constantly. And she would always be in the corner chain smoking and playing this game called Ultimate Wizard. And
it's an incredible image.
And she had a really ravelly voice and everything. It was kind of crazy. And my friend introduced me to her, and she told me, like, I can only come there if I had things to give or contribute or trade. Otherwise, don't bother coming. And so at first I made these levels in Ultimate Wizard that I would give her, and she loved that. So she's like, you can have whatever you want. And then like later on, she got bored of that. So I started making games, but it'd be in BASIC, and she didn't really like them. So then one of the guys I met there said I should talk to this guy named, his handle was Riff Raff. He knows assembly language. And I'm like, it's like, it's machine code. It's talking like you speak to the machine directly and it makes everything faster. And I'm like, what? So like he introduced me to this guy named Riff Raff, who I never knew his real name. I know that he worked eventually for like NEC, and then he did some stuff for like Activision later. I eventually learned his name, but I always remember his Riff Raff now. And so I met this guy first on a BBS, and we're talking, and he sent me some samples of machine language, and I kept asking all these questions. He was a little annoyed at first, but then I kept asking all the right questions. And eventually I was able to like start coding really cool things in machine language that he was kind of teaching me. And he recommended a few books to me. And so I went from basic to machine language. And there was a little step in the middle where I understood how basic worked. And then I would do a little bit of machine language with basic. And then I would do a little bit more machine language, a little bit more machine language. And eventually I just did everything in machine language. So at that time it was 6502 machine language. And when you talk about machine language or assembly, you're usually referring to the language that the processor speaks. And in this case, it was 6502 that I understood, which was not too different from, say, a Z80, which would end up being in the Game Boy or the Spectrum. And this sort of thing. There's a very popular processors back then. There's like the 6502 and its family of processors. And there was the Z80 and its family of processors. So I grew up with a lot of 6502 assembly. And that was kind of my transition to more grown up stuff.
Okay. I had intended to ask you if you ever did the thing where you typed code in from the back of a magazine or like recorded it from the radio in like analog form. But like, it sounds like you blew right past that stuff. Though.
Wait, you recorded stuff from the radio?
Oh yeah. Oh, heck yeah. Yes. Not only that, my uncle was a ham radio operator and they had a channel where somebody would broadcast wares, games over this channel and you would record it on tape and you could load it into your Commodore 64. So we're getting wares from like Russia or something like that. And we're loading them on a Commodore 64.
I've heard of the radio stuff, but I've never thought about harnessing a ham radio for that purpose. That is some real like post-apocalyptic piracy.
I just can't believe that there was an elderly lady in your neighborhood who had a ratioed pirate house for software in the 80s. That's like, just my mind is exploding here.
Greets from XXX, Mrs. Cripps XXX.
Her son ran this bulletin board that was a very popular zero-day wares board. And I don't remember the name right now, but I remember bringing it up like years ago. And one of the guys in a business meeting was like, I used to go to that board all the time. Like, oh my God.
I really appreciate that everybody's entrance into early game development seems like it's a comic book character origin story, like chain smoking old lady, like the shadowy dude named Riff Raff.
Well, the thing that's weird about this now that we don't think about now, especially people who are coming up now, don't realize is that like I lived in Northeast Tennessee and there wasn't really any place that sold computer software outside of like WordPerfect and stuff like, you know, like business software. So if you wanted to get games, the computer show came around twice a year. And other than that, it was either you had a friend who had access to some BBS and you brought him some floppy disks and he'd bring you back games, or there was nothing like you couldn't go to GameStop.
It's true.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like you touched on this a little bit. You got your hands on books, you tracked down people that knew stuff that they could tell you, but like, it's so hard for me to visualize in the pre-internet kind of before era how you would access like repositories of knowledge like that. Like it's such a, like an esoteric and arcane subject to dive into without, you know, all the incredible amounts of knowledge at our fingertips these days. Like it seems like that must've been like just kind of hard scrabble, like learn what you can, where you can.
Oh right? Yeah. So you mentioned computer groups before. I would go to computer groups with my dad and there was this one called the Ford Commodore User Group, I think is what it was called. It was Ford Motor Company. And you never really met the people who made games, but in Michigan, where I grew up, there was a lot of people who did create a lot of software around there, and they created a lot of like bulletin board system software and stuff like that. So they would tour around to these user groups. And I remember, I think that was the user group that Peter Molyneux, for some reason, was in the U.S. touting something from that he was working on for either the Commodore or the Amiga or something like that that was coming. Or no, it was Commodore 64, I think. And he managed to just come by this user group. And like before I even knew who he was or anything like that, like it was years later, I'm like, wait, why was he there?
You experienced the rare 80s.
Yeah, I mean,
Molyneux?
I remember his hair was like coming out of like he looked like Krusty the Clown almost. and you know, it was just like one of these things where these people kind of come around and you would hope that you would meet somebody who knew the inner knowledge of how a machine worked or that sort of thing. So you ended up more often than not just writing letters to people. I wrote letters to Activision, Electronic Arts. And occasionally somebody would write back. I remember somebody from Atari wrote back and explained some concepts of programming. Somebody from Activision did. But more often than not, people would think you were just like some weirdo looking for free games. So they would just send you flyers or where you can order stuff. But it was hard. It was really hard to get that information. So that's why the magazines with the type-in programs or Compute, which was a really big popular magazine for programming, they would publish spiral-bound books that had all kinds of crazy nuggets of information on how to read joysticks, read paddles, do sound, do graphics and that sort of stuff.
Did you ever read the books that had like they're like choose your own adventure books where you had a puzzle that had to be solved by writing a computer program?
Yes.
And of course, if you went to the back of the book, the puzzle, the solve was there, but you could figure it out on your own. And it was the most satisfying thing in the world to write like some, you know, 100-line basic program to solve a math problem.
It wasn't like something, it was like a something 2000 series or something like that was one of them. And there's a few different series.
Yeah, that's the one I had.
They were really cool. But I remember like by the time I started like kind of getting into those, I'm like, this is all cool. But I was already moving on to like, I want to get like raster interrupts and more colors on screen and like how to get stereo to come out.
So what was the point where you started making money making games? Like when did you go from amateur to professional on that stuff? What was the first game you sold?
The first game I sold was in a weird homemade box that I was selling at the local computer store. And it was a Qbert clone called Sir Bounce-a-Lot.
That's not bad. That's not bad.
And you were like a spring hopping around on like the cubes like from Qbert. But instead of like just changing colors, which you were doing, you're also trying, because I was just a kid, I was like 14 maybe. I'm like, you're trying to save these druids that are crossing this weird bridge that's being attacked by these. Well, it starts being attacked by flower pots, but then it gets attacked by meteors and everything else. So it's just this weird, doesn't make any sense game. I look back on it now going like, what was I thinking? But it was the first one I sold, and it did pretty well in the computer store to the point that I thought, like, okay, if I could scale this up and I could actually get real distribution, I could probably make money. So that was kind of my wake up. And the real, like, I really kind of broke out when Game Boy was near the end of its initial black and white life cycle. Because I went to college, you do all that other stuff where it's like you're a kid, you want to do other stuff in life. And then it was like right around when I was getting out of college, I started to get back into programming because I kind of missed it. And processors have kind of come a long way. And I used to do assembly programming. So the closest thing to what I used to do was the Game Boy. So I started reverse engineering the Game Boy with some documents I found online. I had this like really rudimentary hardware. And I was able to write my own carts. And from there, I was able to get more and more stuff working over time. I recreated the game Yar's Revenge. Remember the old Atari game?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the best cover, art on that whole system.
I agree. And so I made that game and I posted online for people to check out. And somebody said that I should show it to Howard Scott Warshaw, who was the guy who created the original Yar's Revenge. And he gave me his email address, said, like, send it to him. So I did. And Howard wrote back. And he's like, this is really cool. Where are you? And I'm like, well, I'm in Michigan. I know you're in California. He's like, well, I'm going to be in Michigan next week. Where are you in Michigan? And I told him, and it happened to be going to a hotel for some convention that was literally like 2 miles away. And so we met up, my friend and I, we got together, who helped me with the music and stuff on it. And we met with them one night, and this is before everybody knew the story of Atari or the story of E.T. or the story of any of that crazy stuff that happened before. And he regaled us all night with everything that happened at Atari and all the whole history of Atari. And then he was getting into all the technical stuff. And he talked about everything that he was doing in Yar's Revenge, why he had to do the stuff the way he did it. He talked about all the stuff he wanted to put in, but there was no way to get it in time, as well as with all the technical limitations. So I ended up putting all those features into the Game Boy version of Yar's Revenge. And that was my first commercial, like real commercial game. It was published by Telegames in like 97, I think. Or it was at least started in 97. Okay. And then that went out there. And that paid for a lot of stuff like home theater and those kind of things that I had never thought I would afford ever for a while. So that was my first kind of break. And then after that, I started working with Digital Eclipse, Andrew Ayer, who's my partner now in the same business. And we did the first kind of color games for Game Boy Color that were not Nintendo. So it was Midway's NFL Blitz, Mortal Kombat, and there was another one. And we launched those, and those did extremely well. And that was it. Like, once those kind of hit, they sold like ludicrous amounts. We suddenly realized Game Boy, even though the black and white had died, the Game Boy Color was taking off. And I had, at that point, worked on so many games since. From there to today, I think I just went over 300 games I've worked on.
Wow.
Holy cow.
That's a big number.
It's too big.
I wanted to ask if you had much professional kind of hands-on experience designing and building arcade games, but it sounds like by the time you were really getting into it professionally, the arcade scene was, I mean, you know, it didn't die immediately, but like late 90s, turn of the century is when, you know, consoles started kind of surpassing what arcade machines could do. So did you get a chance to work on any arcade cabinets directly or?
No, that was my dream because like I was racing the clock. I really wanted to get to the point that I could work on kind of crazy fantasy hardware. Because if you think about it, arcade machines were fantasy hardware because You had a specific budget. Totally. You could use whatever you want to make a really cool experience within that budget. And so you would always have the latest and greatest processors, graphics and displays and sound and all stuff. And meanwhile, like the home stuff would always be much cheaper and really harder to work with. So I always wanted to do that. But the closest I got at that time was just recreating those arcade games. And I never really got like source code for a lot of stuff back then. So I'd have to try to mimic and recreate games, like one of my favorites being Galaga. I remember making a version of that. And I would try to get it so precise and arcade perfect that I ended up learning just by doing that how this stuff kind of worked, which I still do today, almost the same process. There's times when we can't get source code, so we have to recreate a game. And it's like an observational port. You're looking at everything, dissecting it. You're reverse engineering whatever you can when you get the stuff. But really, you're just trying to understand and get in the head of the people who created the game and understand how their logic works and everything like that. And what you find, and I was just discovering this earlier today, I'm working on a project that's very similar to this, where at the onset, I'm looking at it like, there's no way we can reverse engineer this, but I'll start putting stuff in that mimics what's going on. And before I knew it, like half the work's being done because the way I was implementing things is exactly how the game does it. And a lot of the stuff I thought I would have to figure out just started to fall into place. And I didn't really have to do anything. And you see these weird eccentric moments in the game that you're like, why would they do that? But it's just a natural progression of just the implementation of some of the mechanics that it just does it without having to implement it. It's so cool.
I'm going to have to resist going off on like 18 different tangents during this conversation. But when you're reverse engineering an old game like that, I assume you're not just doing it by eye. You know, like what kind of tools are you using to do that in like a quantifiable way to like measure stuff before you try to attempt to remake it?
So when you have no source code, there's a few things you're going to have to do. Like one, you want to make sure you have the original hardware because you'll want to use that to get exact timing, exact graphic look, feel, and everything like that, sound. And then you'll want to try to modify that hardware. In this case, this game was also on the Commodore 64. And so while it's on the Commodore 64, we do know in the past that it was ported from another machine to the C64 source. So the logic is all exact. So because it's on the Commodore 64, I actually have, it was called the Ultimate 264 motherboard, which is this crazy beast. If you want to look it up, it's a modern version of the Commodore 64 that uses all the original chipset. It's all expanded, but also has all these debug capabilities. So I put the game on there and I'm able to step through the process and the logic as the process is going through the game and see exactly what's going on at any moment. So I'm able to log game states, memory usage, all the stuff that's going in there. And I start to see a picture of what the game's doing and how it's thinking through that. And then I'm capture video. And oftentimes I'll get video. I'll use high speed recording to get move sets or things where I know there's some complicated movement and behavior. I'll record all that so I can just look at it and make sure that the weirdness of the machine and what it's trying to do with the game is being replicated by the stuff we're recreating as well. So you'll do things like with Street Fighter, where you know when you press the button, you know that delay to screen, it has to be factored in. Also, like what happens when it gets to screen, what's on screen when that button's released, and all these sorts of things. You have to really look at all this video and try to make sure that everything is being replicated exactly like that, and that the color and all the stuff that's showing up on the screen is also replicated. And then all that stuff aside, you start building a disassembly. So the tools that you use are they have a whole bunch of things. Like in this case, the game I'm doing it, there's a disassembler called DASM that's lets you disassemble a family of processors, older processors, and in this case the Commodore processor, which is a version of the 6502, 6510, I think. I'm able to disassemble that then as well, and I could, the stuff I'm stepping through, I can map to that and start taking notes on that disassembly. And so I'll outline sections that's like, oh, here's the player in this state, say he's standing, and here's a jumping state, and here's this. So I'll start putting those notes in, and then eventually, as I start going through that stuff, I start to deduce other things that are going on in the game. I can figure out, oh, this draws the screen, this moves the map pointers to let our screen scroll, this is audio routine, and this audio routine calls all this data, so that must be the driver here that then looks at all this different data that drives the driver. So all this stuff starts to come into focus, and then usually what happens is you have some amount of time up front, say a majority of the time up front is all understanding the stuff. And then it's a really short time before the game just starts working on the new target platform you're building it on. So it's like this really weird miracle happens where for the longest time, you're like, oh, I don't know if this is ever going to work. I don't know if it's ever going to work. And usually you're super frustrated. You compile and you check something and suddenly it's just the whole game's up and running. And you're just looking at it like, oh, okay, there it is. And you're playing it. And it's like, you don't see it coming. It just happens.
How did that happen?
How often do you ever get source code for these old games that you're reporting over, or not really?
I'd say 20 to 30% of the time we get source code, and the rest of the time they don't have it, the people who own it or whatever. And then out of that, if I say all the games that we work on, we end up finding the source code ourselves probably 60 to 70% of the time. So we'll look at who made the game or who worked on it. And we'll just do, I mean, we call it kind of like digital archaeology. We go out and try to track down who might have a copy of the source to some game. So for instance, NFL Blitz that I worked on before, since then, there's been a lot of discussion and there's been all these interviews where people are like, the source got lost because what they did at Midway was as soon as that first game came out, they started working on it again and they didn't really save a state of the game. They just worked on the next year's version on top of it and they kept doing stuff. But when I made that Game Boy game, it was right after they made the first NFL Blitz. So I went looking through all my stuff and I found that I have the original NFL Blitz source code. That's the original untouched arcade release. So I'm like, all right, this belongs in a museum. So I make copies of that. I make sure I get that out to all the appropriate people. So Video Game History Foundation or the Strong or the, I always want to say Video Game History Foundation, but it's the Video Game Museum and History Museum in Frisco, Texas. Those guys, all these people are really good to get these things out to. So I know that there's multiple locations that people can go and find this.
Do you have any, this might be a touchy subject, do you have any clandestine stories of like squirreling away source code or like kind of making sure it lives on?
Yeah. There's plenty of those. Kind of way? And well, there is one, I won't mention names, but like when Lucasfilm was moving from the Letterman building and like Marin or wherever it was up there to the new building here in the Presidio, I got that wrong. When they were moving before the Letterman, not the Letterman building, before the firehouse building, wherever it was that they were in Marin, that one. When they were there, they were on the ranch and then they moved to this other building. In that transition, the person who was looking over a lot of the source code went basically to the head of the studio and said, what should I do with all this source code? If we're going to move, I want to make sure it's in one spot. And the guy was like, we don't need it. Just toss it. And so the guy freaked out because like he was the only one that was keeping anything. He's like, I don't want to toss this stuff. So he ended up backing all up onto these CDs and they told him not to take it. Like he has to destroy it. So he didn't want to do that. So he hid them in like it had a drop ceiling. He hid them in the drop ceiling. Cause like, I don't want to destroy it. It's kind of like one of those stories, like old fairy tales where like, you know, kill the baby. And then they run into the woods and like give the baby to somebody. It's like, he kind of did that. Like he had to save it.
Yeah.
And so he put it up in the ceiling and for years, so many years, it sat there. And then finally, when Lucasfilm's come around to like, oh, like we should reissue some of these old games. Where do we have source? And they realized they didn't have any of that stuff. One way or another, that hidden source managed to stay there, had been discovered, and a lot of stuff has been able to be saved.
Man, foresight. Wow, that's an incredible story. So, like we said, the arcade games are kind of a big reason we wanted to bring you on here. So I wanted to step back a few years from what we've been talking about to kind of, I don't know, let's say the first like 10 years, 10, 15 years, like from Pong up through, I don't know, through Space Invaders, through Donkey Kong, like mid 80s, let's say. I personally, like, I know what a computer is. I know what the guts of it look like and like what all the parts do. You know, it's a generalized machine that can do a lot of different things. And like even a game console, even though it's a lot more specialized, is still like somewhat familiar to me, but the innards of an arcade game from that era are like practically a black box. So I was wondering if you're able to like step us through like just sort of what the component parts are and like how things were stored and how information moved around in there, you know, like what kind of processing was going on, how images got to the screen, stuff.
I can do it on a very high level because even I, like, cause I was more of a software guy trying to understand how the hardware stuff worked. And now that I've kind of gone through stuff and we've done a lot of emulation of arcade machines and all stuff, it's like I still understand them from a very like high level and a software perspective. When you start getting out of the nitty gritty, it's amazing that these things even work to me, because back in those days, some of the very first things, like if you look at Pong, like that's a good one. That board was designed just discreetly. There was no concept of RAM. There was no processor per se. It was just all these chips used for timing and to turn things on and off at specific moments and read input from things to just change like current essentially without being like RAM or anything else. So everything that's on the screen is because the layout of the board and the chips chosen and the timing used turned basically created a signal that would then prepare and then display that image on a black and white television. And so it's really hard to kind of like a good way to put it is like to understand how display works. So an old CRT back then, black and white or color, basically the beam starts in the upper left and it's like reading a book. It goes across, gets to the end, goes to the next line and goes across and does all this. And was it like 60? One frame is like,
59.97. Yep. Yeah.
And it's so fast and so crazy how that's working, but it's doing it in precise timing. So if you get a chip that matches, say, the horizontal line time and it has a clock tick, and you say, okay, this clock, every so many fractions of like a second, is always going to, like, that clock's always going to hit the certain spot at the edge of the screen as it goes down. And I'm going to, like, I know then I can determine when the beam resets to the left and when it starts again. And when it starts, I can then, on certain time frequencies, change the signal to white or black or whatever you want to do to create like a paddle, a dotted line down the screen, or these sorts of things. And so you're just running, you're basically using a clock to, say, turn something on and off specific times. And then if you want to move a paddle, you're changing when it's deciding to turn something on and off, and it's waiting for that clock tick, and it happens. And everything kind of evolved from there. So this is before bitmap displays or anything else. You're literally just telling the beam what to display at what time. And you just need to know that you're at the top of the screen every so often so that you know that a vertical sweep has happened and you're getting ready to do another frame. And that's kind of how the early things work. And I don't know how they even figured out how to do that or any of that stuff. Like Al Alcorn and all these guys who were pioneers in the space, Nolan, and of course, our friend Ralph Baer, a few years ago, they all figured this thing out. And from there, that's when things started to explode, because once they figured that out, and then microprocessors suddenly came out, and that was much cheaper to deal with because you can have a unified processor with some RAM. They started moving all those basic techniques to a processor. So now the processor would have a timer and it knew when to turn things on and off. So the Atari 2600 is very similar to a Pong system, and in fact was designed to be essentially like a more glorified version of a Pong system. And so it's sprites. So if you think of it as the Atari 2600, it's not very different. It was designed to have two sprites, so two paddles. It has a play field in the background, very low res, which is for you to do lines and dotted lines. And then they had definable sprites, which were meant to be score numbers. So you'd have those. And that's all the 2600 was meant to do. And then you could do whatever you want with those. It doesn't have an X and Y position for sprites. Wow. It doesn't have any of that stuff. So when you see an Atari game with something that's moving horizontally on the screen, it's doing the same trick that they did for Pong, but now in software. It's counting cycles and saying, oh, draw it here. So there's no X and Y. You have to create that as some weird construct on your own and then wait and time things to have it display. So the fact that they got anything to show up on a 2600 is a miracle, let alone some of the stuff we see later in its life cycle.
Did this stuff all evolve from like the old oscilloscope games, like the games that were basically, you know, because oscilloscopes, you have basically what, like two inputs or something, and then it draws lines on a screen. It seems like this is like a natural progression from that.
I mean, it kind of is, because I think what was happening, if you look back on like, say, PDP computers and those early like computers that'd be over at like MIT and stuff, they had vector displays that were basically oscilloscopes. So Space War and all these things were all developed on that. And I think a lot of people learned, especially those early, the early designers learned on those machines and then came to these new platforms. But they brought with them a lot of principles in design on hardware as well as software from that era. So you'll get people like Don Daglow, who did Utopia for Intellivision and all these other great games later. And you look at like, look at Space War and its evolution when Nolan created computer space and all this stuff for the arcade. All those things, their life started back then on those kind of systems and then evolved these newer platforms, but they kept a lot of the logic process and a lot of the approach the same.
So did you talk about like this state in arcade development of kind of, it sounds like reinventing the wheel from game to game over and over. I think about like the later years of arcade development is when you finally started to hear named common hardware platforms, like, you know, your System 11 and your Model 2 and that kind of thing. But was it all through the 80s that the state persisted of just kind of people were just cobbling together the parts that they needed on a per game basis? Or were you seeing more common hardware platforms emerge even then?
More common hardware platforms started to emerge because eventually what would happen is people started to realize that you could, it's like riding a bike. Once you started getting good at it, you didn't want to just suddenly like then learn how to ride a unicycle or whatever. It's like, if you're good at it, you can get better and better at it. And so Williams, they did a great job. They had the MCR 1, 2, and I think MCR 3 platforms. So it went from like Wizard of War to like Robotron type stuff to like Journey and Tron and all these things were all evolutions of a certain kind of platform. And so every manufacturer started to coalesce into their own kind of platform. They would evolve it a little bit here and there, but it was one of these things where it made it cheaper for them to one, develop and release software and hardware for new arcade cabinets. But also they started to learn that not every game was a hit. So they would put something out there, like look at Radar Scope from Nintendo. They put this shooter out there that Miyamoto, I think, worked on, or at least was periphery to, goes out there, bombs horribly. They use the same platform to create Donkey Kong after that as a result of this game being so poor. And they were able to just swap that board out. So they were able to tell operators like, hey, I know that game sucks. Sorry, but look at this one. And all you have to do is pay this little price to switch it out. And they could still make a profit because they're making money on the board, but they didn't have to ship this heavy cabinet and all this stuff. So really what happened is the ability to swap games into these cabinets then would eventually lead to like the JAMA standard and all these people putting into the same interface for the visuals and the sound. And then the boards themselves having a lot of similar interface by manufacturer.
Do you have any sense of if a lot of arcade operators were doing those board swaps themselves back then, or was that something that like the game makers would need to send a technician out to do? How complicated was that?
So there was a whole ecosystem. You had, you know, the arcade owners, then you had operators and distributors who were people who would be the middle people to say an arcade manufacturer. So those middle people ended up being the ones that would go in there and do a lot of these swaps. They would mark up all their stuff. So the chain was really good. It was really healthy. Like publisher or creators would sell to distributors who would then sell to arcade or lease and rent to arcades and that sort of thing. So it was a really healthy time in the 80s and early 90s for arcade machines.
I think we kind of wanted to ask you to also put on your arcade machine owner hat a little bit here as someone, again, who has a Street Fighter II and a Namco machine sitting right behind him. Because, you know, people are into arcade machine collecting these days, like they are making their way into more and more people's homes. I guess our first question is just like, what are the practical realities of owning a machine or two at this point in terms of like parts breaking down, like maintenance? Like, is there anything you need to worry about maintaining over time? Is there anything you need to worry about, like hurting yourself on if you're tinkering around in there? Like, what are the kind of the do's and don'ts?
Well, the number one most dangerous element of any classic arcade machine is the monitor. If it's an old CRT. I've known a lot of people who've shocked themselves really badly on there's this section in the back of the monitor where a lot of the high voltage emanates from, and it's under the suction cup that's on the tube. If you lift that up or try to touch anything underneath that, like there's a good chance you could die. So don't do that. And that's also that's also the part of the machine that breaks down the most. Everything else is easy to maintain. Even the motherboard, you can get that all fixed. Really, these things are so simple, and a Google search can get you figuring out how to take care of the rest of the machine. The monitor is the hardest part. You can learn how to replace the capacitors on a monitor and do all stuff yourself, but the reality is, and the hard, cruel reality is, CRTs are disappearing rapidly, and resuscitating them over and over again is not going to be... They can't last forever, and nobody manufactures them anymore. So at the end of the day, these machines are slowly losing what made them so special. And what I mean by that is CRTs, the way they display the screen, how bright they are, the way the color on the screen gets merged together was all taken into account when they were making these games. So when you switch those monitors out to what most people do and they get like an LED or LCD monitor and put that in, any sort of flat screen or whatever, the problem is those are too clear and they don't recreate the artistic intent of the original game. So when you take something like, let's say Altered Beast, and you put it on an LCD or LED monitor, and you put it in an arcade cabinet, you see the pixels really rich and everything like that. But the artist, when they were designing that game, did not want you to see the pixels. They chose colors and everything, and put them next to each other in certain combinations to allow for the CRT to bleed that over and give you the impression that there was more color than the hardware could output. And so when you put those screens in, you lose that quality, and actually you lose the entire artistic intent of the person who created the artwork for that game by putting it on a device that wasn't intended for it. But unfortunately, that's stuff we're going to have to deal with. So when you're getting an arcade cabinet, just know that the CRT's lifespan is getting shorter and shorter, and you can get it repaired by people. There's people everywhere that can repair these, but ultimately that's the thing that's probably going to go. So your next best option are these LED and LCD type monitors, and there's people who are actively working right now to recreate what happens on a CRT through a hardware solution that can go between the board and these new monitors, these HD displays. And what that will do is try to mathematically reproduce what happens on a CRT and various CRTs, and then give you that input or give you that output to your screen. It does introduce latency, and that's why these things aren't readily available now, is because people are trying to figure out how to do this in a way that doesn't introduce too much latency, because these machines and all these games were built to have near zero latency in their play. So if you're trying to play Robotron and it has latency, that game sucks. You have to have it with almost no latency.
Yeah.
And most games back then, that's how they are. So it's a really hard problem to solve, and people are actively working on it, but we haven't found a solution yet. Everything else, though, you can find.
Okay. Do you think we'll get there with that visual effect? Like, do you think, you know, obviously, like, latency issues and other technical challenges aside, do you think it is achievable to perfectly replicate that look once, I don't know when the CRT apocalypse is going to happen, but once we're at that point, do you think we'll be able to actually still recapture that through these other techniques?
There are so many passionate people working on this problem right now that I'm sure we're going to get there. And I've seen some incredible demonstrations. I've seen things on NEC hardware, for instance, that simulate a CRT and does it really fast, that it tricks your mind to think that that's what's going to be. There's still latency. So I think we're really close to having it solved. And even for emulation, if you're going to do emulation right now, that's moving ahead so fast that we'll get to that point to where you won't have input or processing latency. We have stuff going on in emulation right now where we predict forward, we call it. And so what you're doing is every possible combination the player could be thinking about doing in the next few frames, it tries to emulate all those things. So by the time it gets input, it knows what to display without having to process it post-input. So it's able to just fetch and send stuff over so that it tries to create the sense of zero latency.
Because the possibilities based on some of the old games is relatively straightforward, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's an 8-way joystick, and it's really just like it has an up and a down on and like a button. So you can predict a lot of things forward, whereas analog games, you don't know the precision and all that kind of stuff. So analog controlled games. So those older games we're getting really far with, but it's going to be later when we do emulation in the future. That it won't be so bad because they were designed for digital displays.
Here's another one of those tangents. I'll try to restrain myself, but just since you mentioned next gen hardware, I mean, is there anything on the forthcoming consoles or also in the PC space, just the amount of like raw compute that's out there and on the way, that specifically for you as someone who spends a lot of time porting and recreating and remaking old games and kind of resurrecting them and breathing new life into them, like anything in that space on this hardware that excites you in that specific capacity?
Oh yeah. I can't say things in detail, but essentially the graphics processing of these two consoles coming now, plus some of the stuff coming up in the future, they're going to lend themselves well to trying to solve this kind of display recreation issue. Especially since we can have higher resolution to do a lot of that like sub pixel work that we need to do to make it look like it's one of those older machines, and HDR and all stuff. And with higher frequency processing is going to really go a long way. So I think we're going to see a lot of that getting solved on next gen platforms to a certain degree. At least it's going to look beautiful. Things like vector displays, you know, they have that super crisp look and they're very bright. We can get there almost with next generation displays, and it looks like it's a vector display.
I was just going to say, to recreate a hand-built arcade machine from 1981, we need a 12 teraflop computer and a 4K HDR display that can refresh at 120 hertz.
You're wrong. It's an 8K display.
Oh, sorry, my bad. 8K, yeah. And it needs to be vertical, probably, too. Portrait 8K display.
You got to be able to take that thing.
Yeah. That's awesome.
But that's like, honestly, that's what you kind of need to recreate the visuals as they were intended to look. Everything up until then is too low res, or it's not powerful enough to kind of get us there. It's so weird how this works, but that's the truth. Like, people always bring up the waterfalls in Sonic on CRTs, how they look like translucent water coming down on a CRT. When you play it on an HD display, it just looks like a bunch of pixel lines. That's just an artifact that, you know, we're not recreating on modern hardware.
Well, it's just you need a massive amount of overhead to recreate that stuff. Like with Beast Nest, and what's the cycle accurate version? Of Beast Nest, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah.
Like the amount of horsepower that thing needs to actually properly recreate Super Nintendo games is immense, right? Like, it's like orders of magnitude.
Yeah, because every other emulator pretty much has to trick its way through that, whereas the cycle accurate ones require a lot of processing, and also the display requires a lot of processing. Like NTSC, somebody always had a joke. I've heard this joke so many times, but NTSC stands for not the same color twice or something like that. Like,
yeah.
So it's like the display was so erratic and so error prone and just so noisy that like there is no one way to simulate it, but there is a lot of dials you need to create to make it like match what the intent was when something left a factory. So like you we actually, for Mega Man, we had to do this. We had to, when we did the Mega Man Legacy Collection, we made Mega Man the proper blue he's supposed to be. He hasn't been the proper blue since the 80s. And so we actually figured out what monitor he was developed on, everything like that. We got everything tuned to where it was supposed to be. We took the color reading off of a monitor that was a replica of what it was, and then we did Mega Man's blue to be authentic Mega Man blue. So since Mega Man Legacy Collection forward, he's now the proper blue.
Wow.
That's the kind of attention to detail that's gotten you where you are today.
Try.
This is very subjective, but do you like things better the way they are now? Like everything is very, very digital and rigid and regimented, and like things work the way they're supposed to, and like, you know, pixels are pixels, or like, do you miss that era where displays were analog and everything was kind of messy and like you had to worry about straight up, you know, electrons and stuff like that? Like, do you have a preference there in terms of development?
Well, you know, I love modern stuff is just so much easier. It's just a lot easier.
Right.
But it's like, there's the analogy of it being like classic cars, right? Like you can lift the hood and tweak the engine and do all these mods on a car. Those old days for computers and for old hardware is the same way. You could get in there and you didn't have to worry about hundreds of elements of processing being orchestrated over all these ways of communicating and all this stuff. You could get into an old machine and follow everything it's doing and literally get in there and change anything, mod it, to understand it. You could understand an old home computer in a matter of hours if you know what you're doing. That is amazing. So it's like today when I'm sitting there disassembling a game, I'm looking through, I'm like, I'm essentially disassembling something that's really small compared to modern terms. So I can do it pretty quickly, but I'm having much more fun with that because I can see the whole thing at once. It's like playing an old game, say Joust, right? Versus imagine Joust that was like 50 screens wide by 50 screens tall and you had to scroll around to find enemies. I like the Joust on one screen seeing everything, and it's so much easier to do than, say, modern games. So I prefer that. And I like making games that are like older games too. So a lot of the modern stuff I like to work on, we do a lot of like higher end games for next gen consoles and all that sort of stuff. We're not just all classic stuff, but I really enjoy doing stuff that's more classic. I'm working on a game for the new Intellivision called Night Stalker. It's just such a breath of fresh air to work on something that's much smaller systems, and the mechanics are more visceral. Like what you do affects everything on screen, and everything you need to know is all on screen at the same time. That's something just really cool about all that.
So I think we just want to loop back around arcade machines for, we took some questions from our audience. So some people hit us up about some stuff before we move on here. I was glad you mentioned vector monitors earlier. Is that category pretty much in the same kind of dire situation as traditional CRTs in terms of, you know, they're not being made anymore, like they're all going to go away at some point? Or
yeah, vector games unfortunately are in a worse state. Getting a vector monitor or converting a monitor over to something that could display vector is really hard to do now. And in fact, like, we might as well consider them dead. But yeah, vectors are in a really bad spot. There are people who have figured out how to convert vector games to raster displays, but that's not quite as good yet. And people are, again, like, we're trying to figure out how to make that look good. But other people are converting regular displays to vector displays.
Oh, wow.
And so what remains of CRTs, some people are figuring out how to convert those to proper vector XY.
Can you explain just a high level what the differences between a vector and a raster CRT would have been, or a display would have been?
Yeah. So earlier on when I was saying like the raster displays, like a book where it goes left hand corner and sweeps the screen and goes down, a vector, you just tell the beam where to go. So you have so many moves you can make, like so many moves per round, so to say, and you tell the beam to go do that. And so it'll be on or off and you tell it where to go. So you can give it an X and Y coordinate. Usually there's devices that are told to do that, but they're not very different from, say, a laser or like a show laser. So when you see those show lasers where they have an animated horse running and all that kind of stuff, it's using the same kind of process that a vector monitor does. You steer the beam, you tell it where to go and what color it should be, or if it's on or off.
So what we need to do is convert show lasers and get a phosphor screen that'll glow a little bit, and then play our vector games painted on the side of a building outside E3 next year, and we're good to go, right?
That's exactly it. You know, I played Star Wars the arcade game on the side of a building that was hooked up to a show laser.
And wow,
it's pretty amazing.
Oh, that sounds so good.
I have possibly the most under the hood question I could possibly ask about a CRT right now. But how does the electron gun aim itself? Like, what is the mechanism that it actually uses to direct the beam? Like, I'm sure there are no moving parts in there, but is it just kind of like a wide emitter that it's able to sort of specify angles?
Yeah, so it's kind of
out of
this is where, or there's some similarities, and it's a little bit out of my realm of expertise a bit, but like there's similarities to what that's why you can convert a CRT to a vector display. there's where the CRT was designed to display images in a very specific way over the air. And so things, data is being received in a certain format that when it's just sent to the display, it just knows to put it in that order and everything just falls into place. But you can unwind that and you can change its timings and everything else. And so at the end of the day, the beam is just like the vector monitor, but it's just being told by the hardware that's hooked up to a CRT to do things a specific way. Now, there's a lot more to it than that's beyond my knowledge, but that the monitor itself, the tube, and what some of the hardware that's there is the same, and it's just how it's being driven by the stuff that's attached to it.
I think maybe the most insane thing about all this to me is that we're talking about, like, what, practically 100-year-old technology at this point?
Pretty much.
Yeah, wow. So... couple more, let's see, arcade questions here. Like, just any if people are out there looking at machines, like they want to buy their first arcade machine, or, you know, get into that, you know, plunge down that rabbit hole, like anything in particular to look for out there if you're shopping around, if you're looking at machines, if you want to inspect one that you're thinking about, you know, taking ownership of?
I mean, the biggest thing is if it turns on, that's the biggest thing. If it comes on, you can hear everything. Good. Most of the work's already done. But then make sure you're playing with the volume knob, listening for the sounds and stuff you recognize from the game, because a lot of these games will sometimes have bad audio or chips that are messed up. There's a self-test that most games have. So before you go, Google the manual for it and how to trigger the self-test. So you can go and trigger that self-test and have it just go through its own diagnostic. And that will tell you pretty much everything you need to know as well. And then the screen, make sure that the convergence on the screen is pretty nice. So if you see a white line, usually in that self-test, you'll see they'll put a white grid up. And convergence, the RGB, the red, green, and blue beams, they're aligned to be in exactly the same spot at each position that the beam comes across. But if they're not, they're deconverging. So you'll see blue to the left of white or to the right. You'll see green off or whatever. And that's more problematic to fix. You can get it fixed, but that's one of the things to align and calibrate on a monitor if you're not used to it. So just look for those things. I wouldn't say don't get a game for any of those reasons, especially if it's a rare one you've been looking for, because most stuff is fixable in a game. But just be aware of that stuff when you're doing it, because you can use that to haggle your price down and get what you feel is probably more fair for that kind of game. And Craigslist, honestly, is one of the best places to look, because there's usually a lot of people who don't know what to do with these machines. And usually when it's posted, it's because somebody's exhausted about lugging this thing around and maybe in the middle of a move, whatever. They don't want to deal with it. So they're giving it for a really good price, or to a good home, as you usually
see. The Sunday afternoon California Extreme discount is what I like to think of that one as.
Oh, yeah, that's the best.
What do you worry about, like phosphor burning and stuff like that? I assume if you're going to be playing Donkey Kong on a Donkey Kong cabinet and Donkey Kong's burned into it, it's probably not that big a deal, right?
Yeah. At this point, like, beggars can't be choosers. I have a bunch of monitors that have Miss Pac-Man burned into it. That's the one that you usually find. And, in a dark room with an arcade on or a kid monitor on, you don't see that anyway. It's only when the lights are on and like the machine's off that you really notice it. So if you're really picky and that sort of thing, spend the extra money and get the CRT you want. But if it looks good in the dark, like all of us, then go for it.
Cool. So I thought, before we wrap up here, I think we wanted to kind of move things into the modern day a little bit in a couple of ways.
Yep.
Let's start with preservation is a thing that, you know, people who are passionate about the medium talk about more and more. And obviously you're heavily involved in the Video Game History Foundation, and there are a couple other organizations out there. How do you feel about where we're at right now? Like, do you think that we're getting to a point where we're doing a good job of archiving a lot of this stuff and saving it? Or do you think there's still a lot left to do to really cover our bases?
If there was a chart that would say, you know what? We're nowhere right now. We're below zero at the moment.
Wow.
Because
wow.
even in this day and age, a game that came out last year, I've had so many conversations because we do a lot of port work. We do a lot of sequelization and all that sort of stuff for games. That source code goes away too. And it's mind blowing to me that there is no process when a game is completed that should be understood in every organization to take this source code and put it somewhere safe. Now, every organization, there's the whole problem of like they own it and that sort of thing. But that's also the problem as to why these things fail so many times, because they're so worried about proprietary information getting out there that they'd rather have it go away forever than to use it to build on for another product. And so many companies have these such rich and wonderful IP. That stuff's gone. The original source is gone forever because they decided that they didn't want to spend either the time to have somebody archive it properly, or put it in somebody else's hands because they didn't trust that they would keep it safe, which blows my mind. There's other reasons too, and everything like that. But like, I remember I was working on this port for a really popular survival horror game. I'll just leave it at that. And we're going to bring it to a computer. And so we asked for the source and we got it. And they sent us tapes. They were tape backups. We're like, okay, we'll work with this. And they didn't know what drive they used, but they had, so we figured it all out. Then we go through the tape backups and we found out that half of the source code was overwritten with the current project they're working on there because somebody decided to try to back that up over the wrong things and then bailed on it. And so only half of the source for this now considered one of the most iconic games ever. Only half the source survived and barely usable. Oh, man. And it was the wrong half, by the way. So it was like, wow. All right, that sucks.
Huh. Have you ever gotten source code, like straight up hard copy of source code? Have you ever had to OCR a bunch of reams of paper or anything like
that? Yes. So wow. A few times. There were games that were in development at Williams and Atari, and those companies back then, in some ways, a lot of those older companies were better at archiving than modern companies. They would always print hard copies, and they would also send hard copies to the Library of Congress. And so I think everybody should send source code, anything hard copy, and then final releases to the Library of Congress, because up until about the late 80s, Nintendo and everybody did that. So if you go to the Library of Congress right now, you'll find brand new boxed versions of every single Nintendo game, everything that ever came out in the US are all in the Library of Congress. They're in that hillside in the Library of Congress, and it's an amazing facility. And they keep it all perfect. Saw PC software and everything all over there. But it all stopped around the late 80s, like 88. And then everybody stopped doing it because they felt like they didn't need it. And they're also getting worried about proprietary stuff. But we had to go and find some of these things, whether it was at the Library of Congress or just old archives from like the Atari days. And we were able to reassemble games based off of the source code printouts. And so we didn't even have to do OCR. They're so small that we were just able to just hand type them all back in. It's like the old days with Compute Magazine, typing them all back.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. Back to your roots.
So, well, hold on. So how big is, so if we're talking about like an NES or an Atari 2600 game, like how many lines of code are we talking about for something that we all know, like, I don't know, Pitfall or something like that. It's gotta be thousands, right?
You know, it's like half a binder full when you disassemble it, fully tokenized, or maybe a binder, but it's okay. All the instructions are so small that it's not like, if you were to put them in paragraph format, it's not very big.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, because you're talking like a handful of characters per line, probably, right?
Yeah, like a common one on an old 8-bit processor is like load accumulator, which is LDA, LDA, or 20 or whatever you want to load it with.
What's something cool going on in preservation right now that is a little more unconventional, like either at your foundation or any of these other organizations? Like, you know, source code is a big one, obviously. Archiving not just retail releases, but like beta, you know, dumps of like beta versions of games is pretty big. But I guess to give an example of the kind of thing I'm talking about, like, I see Frank Cifaldi will post, like, he's been getting his hands on, like, press kits from games from back in the 80s, 90s, you know, like the press releases and, like, press materials. And, you know, as someone who works in the press and has for years, like, that stuff's really fascinating to me to see, like, what was Nintendo PR saying about their games to members of the press back in the 80s? Like what are some other examples of, like, interesting peripheral materials like that that are being archived in this effort?
I mean, that's kind of it, right? So, like, Frank has he's incredible, and like he runs the foundation in such an incredible way. And like, he learned early on that to really understand the game industry, you have to see what the game industry wanted people to know about it. But like, in those early days, it was really hard. They didn't really have any outlets to get people to know about it, so they tried everything. And so one of his first like kind of big stories he put out there to help people wake up to preservation was, even Nintendo didn't know when they launched the NES. They didn't have a date.
Wow.
And they still don't. And they didn't know when Super Mario came out. And like, it's just been this long going and ongoing kind of like debate on trying to figure out when the first game was sold. There's been receipts sent to us.
Yeah. Now that you mentioned that, I've looked that up at some point in the last few years. And like, the whole thing did feel really apocryphal when I was reading about it. Cause it was like, oh, like, they put it on test in New York and sold a few hundred units then, maybe. And you know, like, it all seemed very uncertain in the documentation. So
It's really tough to figure that stuff out. And had we had a good record of that stuff, we might know. So like, he set out to go ahead and gather every periodical. There were magazines that were doing coverage of video games that weren't video game magazines and all this sort of stuff. And he's been tracking everything down, and it's painting this incredible picture of stuff. And I top of my head, I can't think of, there's something recently where a lot of the conventional wisdom we have, you start to realize, is really just interpreted history from people's hearsay over and over again, and that sort of thing. So when you start seeing stuff that debunks a lot of things, whether it's like when the NES launched or what different games, why they were canceled or whatever, and you start finding the real stuff back in the day, you start to see a very different version of history that we're not used to. Because at the time, if you think about it, there were very few books that talked about the inside, any inside knowledge of video games. Not until Steve Kent and other people created like Game Over and all that stuff many, many years after the fact. But during that time, there's hardly any insight in what was going on behind the scenes. And so when there is, and we would go back to the stuff and you'd actually find those little bits, you realize that some of these books, like all the knowledge we have is built on just like three books that were kind of from that time. And those three books, you can really tell that they kind of just made stuff up to connect the dots. So what Frank's doing is like correcting all that. It's recalibrating a lot of that history. And we're finding out things that we never knew existed before. Games, technology companies, all stuff that's all painting the picture for why people made decisions and when they did, and how all these companies that we know and love today kind of dodged many bullets to get here. And we know where those bullets and bodies are now for all that.
Do you feel like there are a lot of tell-alls out there still waiting to be written? Like, are we going to see a lot more of that stuff? Like, there's been a little bit here.
Oh, there's so many. There's the book I want to write, like the deathbed book, because I've been told so many stories, so many things that would like, I'll read news stories today about somebody or some company. And like, I know where the body is buried and I know why, how it got there. And it's just like, it's such an uncomfortable feeling because I just want people to know, not out of spite or anything. I just want people to know, like, there's a real weird reason why these people are still around or why this happens or why they're even doing something. And like that stuff doesn't get discussed. And I can't wait to see when those tell all books start to finally come around. There's a certain amount of time I think everybody needs.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be by now, but no, there's stuff that like, let's let their career end first before some things are spoken.
Right. Yeah. We need some equation to describe this, like retirement plus 10 years or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's see here. Where do you stand on in terms of preservation? Like, I guess the public release of materials. I'm guessing the way you guys have run things, you lean much more toward democratizing this stuff. But like, you find like super obscure games like SimCity for the NES, or you know, things that never saw the light of day. Like, do you feel pretty strongly that that stuff should always be made like fully public and like available for everybody to enjoy?
This is stuff we continue to debate all the time, and there's partnerships we have with all these companies, so you don't want to blindside anybody with any sort of like thing that's going to hurt them or their business or anything like that. So there's usually just a like almost per item basis. We have to do a lot of research and a lot of discussing what the possibilities are and why we're doing it and whether or not it has any impact on people who own any potential rights for the things. And so that's why like myself and others that are on the board usually get together, is because we discuss these kind of topics all the time. And more often than not, we want to reach out to these companies and let them know that this is something we want to do, or if there's any benefit of this stuff, we want to coordinate with them to make sure they get what they have if they don't have it anymore, and that they get that back and this sort of thing. So it's just a per game thing. We have to decide how to, in many cases, stuff's debunked or, it's no longer around anymore and that sort of stuff. And we can kind of get that out there. Because like, at the end of the day, the reason it even came into our hands is because somebody saved it. And so a lot of this older stuff that would have been gone forever only exists because people were able to get in other people's hands. And those copies are out there. Like, honestly, the games that get delisted on like the Xbox 360 and all those older machines, the only reason we even have any copies of those anymore is because people pirated them and nobody else backed them up. So it's a weird line you have to walk all the time, because like, you don't want to endorse piracy, but at the same time, that's saved a lot of games from obscurity.
Sure. Speaking of which,
Mrs. Cripps would be proud of me right now. That old lady would be so proud.
Mrs. Cripps just wants people to play games. Games are for the people.
That's all she wanted. Yeah. Ultimate Wizard. Everybody should play Ultimate Wizard.
That's right.
That's so cool.
Speaking of kind of, you know, resurrecting old games, breathing old, you know, new life back into old stuff. How do you feel about, I feel like FPGAs are kind of all anybody's talking about in the playing old games scene at the moment. Like, how do you feel about that stuff? Does it pique your interest or?
Oh, I mean, I have a Mr. FPGA platform immediately to the right of this screen I'm looking at.
Sure.
And I have a game up there right now that I'm working on. In fact, I'm using it to work on that project today. But the analog systems, Analog NT, the Mega
SG,
SG, and all those like incredible. The handheld coming up, I'm sure, is going to be incredible. But the Mister, the M-I capital S-T-E-R platform, is the open source version of all that. It's incredible. It has arcade platforms simulated on that. It has all your old home computers that matter. And every day seems to be more and more features of that stuff. And they add in hardware, say like the Super FX chip for Super Nintendo. That's cool that you have that. But then they put in extra tweaks on there where you can overclock it, or you can do all these different things with that hardware. And then there's a lot of other things you can do to help debug and all stuff with this. So to me, FPGA is kind of, if you're into older games or the future of like classic game playing and all this stuff, I think FPGA platforms are the way to go. They're going to be the ones that are going to support the visual output that we were talking about earlier and all these other extra features. So if you're going to play a classic game on modern televisions, that's the way to go.
Given the open source nature of that stuff with the Mister, do you have any urge to get involved in terms of contributing work, or do you do enough of this stuff as your day job already?
Oh, I would love to. Right now I'm at that point where I felt before I learned machine language. I look at it, I'm like, what? How does this work? Because it's very different from software emulation. Very different. But at the end of the day, a lot of the same process goes into play. So basically what these things are doing is just, they're, to me, I always, like, in my mind, I think of them as like the liquid metal Terminator. You say like, I want you to be a C64, and it just like morphs into a C64, and it sounds and looks exactly like one. And its timings and everything are all just accurate. No latency. That's kind of what it is. It's this magic field programmable gate array that just switches itself over to the layout of all these old systems with precise timing. Like, one of the best ways to know how good this platform is to play an Atari 2600 game on the Mister on an HDTV versus playing it on any of those flashbacks or any console. When you move left and right, it immediately moves left and right. Play Pitfall, and then I'll play it on those other machines. You'll see that, like, the sound is behind by several frames on those other machines, and the player, when you're pushing left and right really fast, is going, like, an opposite direction from what you're pressing at a certain cadence. So, like, when you do it on the Mister, everything's just immediate. It feels great. The arcade games feel the same way. It's kind of what we're talking about before with the display. This stuff's all moving really fast and perfect.
Sure. So do you think we'll get to the point with platforms like the Mister where we're able to do the emulation of the phosphor fade and all that kind of thing over time? Or you think that's next, further down the line?
I think that's a next generation version of something like this, or it's an FPGA platform that's in concert with this.
Okay.
Because that's so much work involved in that, that maybe one of these immediate, like, middle devices that potentially on the horizon here would be something you would hook this into to go out to your output. There's always going to be some amount of latency, but that might be the best
way. Yeah, you know, as much as we prattle on about the Mister here, it's kind of crazy all the other places that FPGAs are showing up in, like, Dreamcasts and GameCubes and, like, acting as, like, video processors, you know, like enabling specific parts of the pipeline instead of acting as the whole thing.
So it seems like engineering. Totally.
It seems like maybe the sky's the limit for those things showing up in places and doing different jobs.
And we're talking about monitors. There's the holy grail of monitors that I think everybody's aware of, which is the Sony PVM series. Sure. Those are the studio grade monitors. Those things are like gold in classic gaming circles. And I finally got my first Sony PVM last year, and I hooked the Mister up to that. And boy, that's bliss.
That's it. You've arrived. You've reached Nirvana.
I have arrived. I feel like I've missed out for so many years.
I'm just going to keep thinking up questions here, but I'm guessing, like, I mean, I'm mostly talking about myself here, but I'm guessing a lot of people still have, like, old CRT monitors from the 90s, like PC monitors. How are those for hooking up to something like a Mister? Because they're not, you know, straight NTSC. They're higher resolution than a TV would have been back then. But, like, are those a good stand-in? Like, are you going to get most of the VGA, same effect there?
Honestly, the second best thing from, like, an RGB and, like, kind of display like that is probably VGA. Playing arcade games on a VGA monitor still looks really nice, but it's not super crisp like an HD display. So you get a little of that artifacting. It's like a good midway between CRTs and an HD display. But it's that instant refresh and the instant display of the data that's really, really good. So I would say if you have an old 90s computer VGA 4x3 screen, hook that up to a Mister or up to a PC with an emulator, the display latency is way less than what you get on an HDTV.
So it seems to me like game development these days has become such a like high level abstracted process. Like, there's, you know, the APIs on top of APIs and, like, billions of transistors, and, like, it's just not the elemental, like, hands-on thing that it was when you started, you know, where you, like, you talk about writing, you know, like, a game is a few thousand lines of machine code and you're writing it directly to, you know, addressing a CPU directly. Like, Do you feel like it's important to expose like the next generation to the type of programming that you did as a kid? Because it seems like they don't have a lot of pathways into that, like really up close, like intimate connection with the hardware that they used to back then, you know, just because of the nature of and complexity of things now.
I think it's an incredible thing to do. Many years ago, before I had kids, I used to go to this place in Antioch, California called Forges, which is this like destination of classic gaming that you used to go to. This guy had a warehouse of old game systems and computers, and you could just buy things for dirt cheap. And I went there one day with a few friends, and this guy came in with his son, and his son was asking for an Atari 800 home computer. And this was like 2006, maybe 2008.
That's wow.
And I remember going like, what do you need Atari 800 for? What are you going to play on? And he's like, the dad basically was answering the question saying like, I never had a home computer when I was a kid. Like he just discovered this through emulation and now he wants to get a real one and he's programming on. I'm like, what? So I was asking this kid all these questions, like, how'd you find out? And like, he would go to all these different websites and all stuff. And he was doing stuff. And I realized he got really hooked on it because it was so hard. Whatever he had as a PC, it was so hard for him to get whatever set up to program on. But he got an emulator for the Atari 800 through this weird esoteric way through a forum going on there. And he was able to just type in programs and things would happen. He didn't have to set anything up. He would just fire up this emulator and start writing stuff. And so it was super easy. So then, flash forward now to where I am. And just like a few days ago, I had my son sitting on the Commodore 64 to my left here. I put it all together for him because he's really into music and writing music. And I told him the whole history of the SID chip and the Commodore 64. It was like beginning days of how synths were made and all stuff. And so I gave him this book that I had when I was a kid that had all this stuff programming sound. He was complaining, the keyboard sucks, it's taking too long to type the stuff in. And once he got the program in and ran it, he loved it. He was already smitten. He feels he understands what's going on there. He wants to do more with it. And he was able to actually like go back to the primeval times or whatever and understand how sound is generated. He was like thinking about waveforms and voices and all these things and like what works best for like creating echo and all this kind of stuff that he never had to think about technically. He'd just press a button for. Now he had total control of it.
That's super cool.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Mike, this is, I guess, the time. Thank you so much for coming by. This is the time for plugs. What do you want to plug? Fire up. Let our audience know about your stuff.
Well, we have a game that came out just near the end of last year called Medieval for PS4. Go check it out. It's a remaster and recreation from the ground up of the Medieval game that was a classic on the original PlayStation.
I could probably do a whole separate podcast just on the process of recreating that thing. But
oh man, that is a big process. That was, yeah, it's a little bit of what we were talking about earlier, but even more. So we did that. And then what else do we have out there? We have all our emulations that we did, Aladdin and Lion King, which were the Disney classics that were on Genesis. And
oh my God, you guys did those.
Super Nintendo.
Holy shit.
Yeah, we did those.
Oh my gosh,
we put,
dude.
Do you see all the video stuff that's in there?
The young Lewis Castle in those videos that we came across was a mind blowing moment, man. Holy shit.
That hair. I mean, we all had bad hair, but that hair.
Those things are.
It's incredible.
Like those things. I didn't even realize you guys did those. Those things are like a really like it's a, like an obvious labor of love. You know, like that's a really nice production, nice menus, nice extras, just nice everything.
That's kind of the thing that we're. So that is a glimpse of what we're doing now going into the future. We go and do documentaries and we find any archival footage we can. So we're going to have videos. We have interviews. We do all this stuff now where we actually want our digital clips titles to be half documentary, half gameplay. So stuff going forward, you're going to be, I think you're going to be very happy with some of the stuff we have coming up. So we did that Lion King, Aladdin. We have the Samurai Showdown collection coming soon with SNK. And there's a really big surprise in that one that I can't wait for everybody to see. And that as a result of us doing a lot of what we've been talking about and going on and trying to find stuff, we found a lot of good stuff for that collection. I think people who are big Samurai Showdown fans are going to be surprised by some of the stuff we've unearthed. What else do we have? I'm working on iDarb 2.
Yes.
Kicked that off.
You drew another red box.
I'm drawing two red boxes now. So things have really leveled up. So getting that pulled together, I'm working pretty hard on that. And then we've got so many projects in the works that we'll be announcing over the next few months. Originally, when we were going to announce stuff at E3, and then E3 kind of went away, we're like, oh, I guess we can spend more time and get like our announcement perfect. So Now we're just trying to figure out, do we go earlier or later and all that kind of stuff. So that'd be pretty good. We have probably about four or five projects in the works.
And then for people who are interested in the foundation, what's the best way for them to dig into some of those materials that are being archived?
So what we'll have and what Frank's going to be talking about coming up here in this for the remainder of the year is how to access that sort of stuff in a way now that we're in this new world. and how that stuff's going to be migrating to some form of online kind of being able to activate it from online and peruse it. So he's working on that right now. We'll have some news coming up, I think, on how that's going to be sorted out. It's been an on and off again kind of thing, because like we're talking about before, there are legal issues to a lot of stuff too. So a lot that's in his archive, we have to make sure stuff that can be public accessible on how to do that. That's all being talked about right now. But he's had, if you just reach out to the Video Game History Foundation and reach out to Frank Cifaldi, and you have any specific needs or you're looking for anything, he's a good place to start. And whether you can get access to the archive directly through Frank, or if you're working for a game, say a game publisher, and you're looking for old source code or who you should talk to, or maybe try to track something down, reach out to the foundation, because they've been instrumental in the stuff we do at Digital Eclipse and other projects as well. So if you're looking to, like we're talking about before, there's so many people who don't have source code anymore. Talk to Frank. He probably knows where that is.
Cool. Very cool.
Mike, thank you so much for coming by. And as always, this is the part of the show where we talk about what's going on the Patreon. We opened up new channels this week.
Yeah, that's right.
On the Discord, Brad.
Discord is booming.
It's there's always like 10 good conversations. I wish I had more time to dig in. We opened up maker channels and video games channels this week. And I think the food channel might be new this week, although that might have been last week. So it looks like we're probably going to add an emulation channel, given the conversations that are happening in general right now. So if you want to find out how to back the Patreon, you can by going to patreon.com/techpod. As always, please tell your friends about the show. We love to get new audience members in, and the best way to do that is with word of mouth. You all telling your friends. I love looking at the Twitter feed and seeing everybody posting about the most recent episode. If you have questions, send them to techpod@content.town, and we'll answer them in a few weeks. And I think that's it. For me, Brad, you got anything else?
No, not unless I just kind of want to ask Micah if I can come hang out in his basement for a little while. It just looks so comforting. It looks like the 80s in there.
You can, and you know what? As long as we can keep 6 feet away. It's not very big of a space, but we could keep 6 feet away.
It's like if my entire childhood and all of my childhood hopes and dreams were encapsulated in a single room, it is that one. And I just can't stop looking at it. So sign off before I come over and invade your house.
Well, take care of yourself, Mike. Thanks for coming by, and we'll see everybody next week. Bye.